Hey, Michael Steele podcast listeners, Michael Steele here with another quick take from the Michael Steele podcast. Check out what's going on right now.
So you guys at Lincoln Project on just looking at, again, at this, at this narrative, and what going to potentially animate and keep the voters engaged in this cycle, put out a new ad. I guess it was, it came out on the 6th of May, going after billionaires, which was an interesting approach. Let's take a quick listen to some of that.
This election is a simple choice. Last time Republicans were in power, they helped billionaires pay less taxes than you. This time, it's even worse. The Republican plan will raise taxes on over half the country. Democrats have a different plan. Raise taxes on billionaires so you pay less taxes. A simple choice. Republicans, you'll pay more in taxes. Democrats, billionaires pay more.
So what is that? What does that say for you right now? Where do you go with that narrative?
So it's a great question. Like, here, first and foremost, like, we're not a policy organization, right? We're a political organization. And so we say, what is it that we need to win an election, right? Rick Scott, the chairman of the National Republican Senatorial Committee, put out this 11-point plan for America, right, which I'm sure you can imagine, Michael, being in the conference room where some nerd from the Heritage Foundation was pitching him on this, right? Like, but in the undercurrent of the you know, everyone skin in the game, everyone pays their fair share, is those people aren't paying their taxes, right? Those people aren't. The problem is that they're not very good at it. They're not very good at what they did. So, you know, he goes on Fox News with John Roberts, right? Fox News is a home game for these assholes, pardon my French.
Right.
And John Roberts goes, so you're going to raise taxes on half the country and get rid of Social Security and Medicare? And he's like, those are Democratic talking points. And John Roberts is like, it's in the plan. It's right here in the plan.
It's in the plan. Right.
And we made an ad like that. And we're like, hey, DCCC, run this. Hey, DSCC, run this. Run this ad 8 gajillion times. Because here's the thing. Whether you want to believe it or not, economic populism is a motivating factor.
It is.
And
it
if you are a Republican voter and you're being told that a guy like Rick Scott, an out-of-touch Washington career politician billionaire, right, who already ripped off Medicare, right, to the tune of billions and got away with it, now wants to take more of your money, right? What is he going to do with it? What's he going to do with that money, right? He's going to be fine, right? But he wants more of your money. And if we know anything, it's like low-income Americans, just like high-income Americans, don't want to pay more taxes, right? And then there's the Medicare and Social Security piece, which isn't in that spot, but we'll come back to, which is, he said he wants to sunset every law that the government's ever passed every 5 years, right? Okay. All right. Well, I don't know how many that is, but it's a lot, right? So, yeah, you know.
And who's going to sit through that session?
Right.
Not
and
Rick so it's Scott. Like,
and so, but, and here's where, as you know, and the Obama campaign was very effective against Mitt Romney and Paul Ryan in 2012, pushing the old lady off the cliff in her wheelchair, which is, you know, George W. Bush wanted to privatize Social Security, got, you know, nobody was willing to go near that, right? Then, you know, Ryan was always talking about some sort of Ayn Randian craziness with entitlements. And the truth is that we haven't thought about the third rail of American politics in a long time, but it's still the third damn rail, right?
Is,
and it's like, you know, it's like, who says, you know, keep your government hands off my Medicare, right?
Right.
Like, they don't really think about it as government-funded healthcare, but that's what it is. And if you tell a bunch of seniors, these assholes are so crazy, they're going to tax your Social Security check, then they're going to take it away, and they're going to take away your free health care. Like, that's bad policy.
Yeah.
And it's bad politics. And so, like, would a bunch of former Republicans otherwise go, you know, take from the billionaires? I don't know. But the other part, too, is that, you know, and again, I'm not much of an economic populist, but I'm getting there.
Right.
Is, like, the guys, the Elons of the world and the Bezoses of the world, like, they're – wealth is so spectacularly, they have so much more wealth compared to everybody else, right? It doesn't make any sense. And so what do? they make noise about going to space and buying Twitter, right? And it just shows that like there is an oligarchy that if it's not already in place, will be soon.
Oh, it will be soon. There's
that, no, that Americans do know they don't like. And if that's a motivating factor to tie those guys to Republicans, it's fine with me.
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree with your point there, because we just don't see it necessarily for what it is, but it is there and emerging. These folks are so damn rich, they don't know what else to do with their money. So yeah, space exploration, which I've always been concerned about. Look, I'm the guy who sits there and looks at the, you know, those science and sci-fi movies from the 80s and 90s and go, yeah, corporate America taking over space was a bad idea in the 80s. It's still a bad idea in the 2020s.
Yeah. Well, and just think about it. I mean, you know, in 100 years ago, in the previous Gilded Age, what did, you know, Mellon do? What did Carnegie do? Right? What did these guys do? They built palaces to the public.
That's it.
Right?
Libraries,
they built museums. Libraries, yeah. Colleges, right? Yep. All of that. These guys build temples to themselves.
Oh,
right? Damn. They think so about true. Like, you know, like, I mean, let's be clear, Michael, every one of these assholes, and you know, my apologies for calling them assholes, has already figured out like where they've got Walt Disney's frozen head. And like, they want their heads in the same place so that they can come back. Right? Like they all believe they're immortal, right? They don't believe they're going to die. And eventually they're all going to end up like Howard Hughes in the top of a Vegas hotel room with their nails in a, you know, their toenail clippings in a jar next to them. Right. Like that's how they're going to end up, because just they are to your point, they are the rulers of their own universe. That's and it. Just like people like that, they can't imagine that anything bad would ever happen to them. While, you know, 320 million other Americans, you know, are trying to figure out why their rent just went up $1,000 a month.
Amen. So before I let you get out of here, you are one of the architects for sure for Lincoln Project. And in doing that work, what have you learned from it? What has it taught you about advertising and getting a message across to people? It is something that is innate to you because it's what your daddy did as the spokesman for Vice President. God, just blanked on the vice president. Back
Quayle.
Thank you. And so, what have you learned about the craft itself?
Sure.
And the audience that you're crafting the messages for.
A couple things. One is that we have never polled or focus grouped anything. We have never focus grouped an ad ever.
Wow.
We never tested an ad. When we do things, we do them based on what we believe will generate an emotional reaction, mm-hmm. Either in a voter or when it came to Donald Trump in Donald Trump, typically anger. Right. And so, you know, stripping away all of that, you know, I remember in 2020, there was an ad, I don't know who did it, for the Maine Senate race, right? Up, and it was like 54 seconds, six policy points jammed into that 54 seconds. And then, you know, a 6 second disclaimer at the end, like it, you could find, you know, spend $3 million on it. Like, is it going to cut through? No, because everybody's seen those ads. Why in 1964, LBJ ran an ad called Daisy. They ran it one time. Which is a young lady, a little girl picking the petals off a flower. She's counting to 10 while there's a deep voice man counting, you know, behind 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, and then a mushroom cloud, right? And they ran it one time. Why? Because it's because Barry Goldwater was considered to be a nut.
Right.
And LBJ's campaign was saying, if you elect Barry Goldwater, that's what you're going to get. And it scared the hell out of the country. Right.
Yeah.
And that's what you have to do, is sometimes you have to take the gloves off. Oftentimes you have to take the gloves off and say, this is what you're really facing. I mean, just in his example, last summer, we got a call from an education organization saying, how do we deal with critical race theory? Like, well, you should say it's when they say that, they're saying the N-word. And they're like, well, we can't do that. I'm like, why not? That's what they're doing. Right. And they're like, but like our consultants say we shouldn't do that. I'm like, fine. Like, we're just telling you what we would do. And we did that in the Virginia governor's race.
Right.
Because, right, it's the same as welfare queens or, you know, whatever it is, right? It's coded language to scare white people in the suburbs. That's what critical race theory is.
That's
and you have to call it out for what it is. You know, people are like, oh, I don't know. I don't know.
I'm
like,
do that.
All right. Like, no, this is fine. But
my
like,
lawyer said, then what the hell are you calling me for? Talk to your lawyers about doing your ad.
Right. And so I think that that's part of the craft. I think the other part too is we are lucky in that, you know, we have one mission, which is to defend American democracy.
Right.
And the only client we have is from our perspective is the country, right? We don't have a president. We don't have a party. We are able, so it gives us an enormous amount of creative freedom to do these things. And the last piece I'll say is because the people that I get to work with every day have been doing this for so long at such a high level that we don't have a lot of the like ego and jealousy of a big campaign, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Everybody has ideas. You know, sometimes your idea wins the day and sometimes it doesn't. And if it doesn't, you go, all right, you know, I'll come up with something else.
Hey, everybody, thanks so much for listening today. Please go to Apple Podcasts and give us a 5-star review. Heck, give us 2 5-star reviews. I love it. Or catch us on Stitcher, iHeart, TuneIn, or wherever you get that podcast thing on. You know how that goes. Peace out.
What was it like to cover President Donald Trump? Hi, I'm Deborah J. Saunders, former White House correspondent for the Las Vegas Review-Journal. I was not one of the stars you'd see in the front 2 rows of the briefing room. I was in the back of the room or standing in the aisles before I got a seat. It was not fake news. It was my life. I get up in the morning and see what the most powerful man in the world wrote on Twitter overnight or blurted out during a call-in to a morning news show, then try to make sense of it all. I should give a warning. There is adult language, although not necessarily from the mouths of adults. Covering the Trump White House feels much better in the rearview mirror. This is Trailing Trump, notes from the back of the briefing room.
Premiering June 14th on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.